Welcome to Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. I am Alex Zalbin, class of 99, your host for this episode. If you want to find out more about the show and the organization, go to alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni, or you can check out the Facebook page, Cornell Young Alumni Programs, for upcoming events, news, volunteer opportunities, and much, much more. Our guest on this episode is Savante Myrick, class of 09. Now, he's a dude just been chilling out, having a good time up in Ithaca, not doing that much. I'm kidding, of course. He is actually the youngest mayor in Ithaca's history. He was elected at age 24. He's also the first mayor of African American heritage, and we're very excited to have him here. Savante, welcome.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you for letting me come back to the Hill and be on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I should also mention you are class of 09, so we're separated by a decade, but we still have that Ithaca connection together.
Yes. And we share a reunion year, which is most important.
That is definitely the most important thing. So your story has been, I think, well told at this point, but just in case anybody is tuning into the podcast and has no idea who you are at all, can you talk about your background? Because you had such a fascinating, very different upbringing that led you to the point of going to Cornell, to the point of becoming mayor of Ithaca.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to, because it does inform, for me anyway, the reason I got into government was because of how I grew up. And I ran for office when I was a junior at Cornell, really to fight for more affordable housing in the city of Ithaca, both for students, which was important to me at the time, but also for families, for mothers and their children. And that's in part because of how I was raised. I was born back in 87 at really the height of what you consider the cocaine and crack epidemic in inner cities. And my father, who is a Navy veteran, fell into drug use and drug abuse, and really launched us, our family, my mother, my two brothers, and me into poverty. My first 6 months of my life, I spent in a homeless shelter. First 8 years of my life, we were housing insecure, moving around a lot, staying sometimes with friends and family, sometimes staying in shelters, sometimes in cars. And I was really fortunate that I was able to be raised in a public school system that really cared about me, surrounded by public school teachers that cared, with occasional assistance from the government in the form of food stamps and welfare, that led me and my entire family, including all my siblings, on to become successful ourselves, taxpaying, contributing members of society. So I always wanted to give back, but I also saw these ways in which our government failed us. And I thought that if we had more people in power who had experiences like I did, we might get some different outcomes and some better outcomes. So I ran for the council while I was still at Cornell. And with the help of a lot of Cornellians, my classmates, my peers, and some alumni, I was able to win. And then 4 years later, I ran for mayor.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the upbringing. And I should mention, just for the sake of clarity, we're actually recording this towards the end of July, but the episode, I believe, is going to go up in September or October. Things change a lot. But there's right now, we're in the middle of a discussion about, are libraries necessary, which personally boggles my mind. Hearing you talk about, though, how important it was to have access to resources like that, but at the same time, feeling like government failed you. Where did you net out there with your upbringing, with being homeless, with being in certain disadvantaged areas and working your way out of that? Do you feel ultimately hopeful about government, negative about government, both at the same time? Where's your head at?
Yeah, it's a good question, especially now. It can be difficult to be optimistic about the state of the federal government. So I guess what I'd say is that I feel neutral towards government, period, and towards any one particular government. What I feel very optimistic about is the power of collective action. I feel optimistic that when we work together to solve problems that are of common concern, we will be very successful. Now, I say that as You mentioned this many controversy over whether or not there should be public libraries. My grandmother was a librarian in our school. In fact, she brought the Dewey Decimal System to the Sherburne Orville Public School System. And don't you ever forget it, all right? That she was the one that did that. And my aunt is a librarian. And I grew up in libraries, places that showed me how to read and imagine my way out of poverty well before I had the chance to work myself out of poverty. Those things, those libraries, that is a collective action. That's a decision made by a community that we are going to pool resources in order to create not just a repository of books, but a community center. And that's what most public libraries are now, are community centers, where you can also get your hands on all sorts of useful information. And that's what I think government is at its best. People often ask me, especially now, are you a socialist, are you a capitalist, are you a Democrat, are you a Republican? Well, the truth is I'm for what works. And sometimes that means, yes, there should be socialized stuff. For example, fire departments, those should be socialized. They are socialized. We socialized them 100 years ago. Why? Because private fire departments don't work very well. Police departments should be socialized. Roads should be socialized. Sidewalks should be socialized. Some things should be left to the free market. You know, food provision, for example, restaurants. You don't want the government running a restaurant. The service would be horribly slow, right? And some things are a mix, right? The housing market in America has always been a mix between private risk and public investment. And what I've come to believe is that government can do incredible, incredible things. I've seen it in my own life. And I've seen too that government can botch some stuff. So I guess I got involved in order to make sure that this institution that I believe in, this institution of collective action, worked smarter, worked more effectively, and honestly worked more efficiently. For me, efficiency and rooting out like government waste and redundancy is really important, because I think honestly, the more waste there is, the harder it is to talk people into taking on these collective responsibilities, these shared responsibilities like libraries, roads, and fire departments.
I definitely want to come back to this and talk about the challenges that are facing us right now, but to take a bit of a step backwards, you grew up in Earlville, New York, which is about an hour and a half drive away from Ithaca. At what point did you decide, okay, Cornell is the place that I want to go to? This is the college that I want to attend.
You know, it's funny. So I grew up an hour and a half from Ithaca. I'd never been to Ithaca. I'd never even heard of Cornell University until about my junior year of high school. When I was something between, you know, I think most of my high school teachers would tell you I was a B student, and that was mostly by like, because of just a standoff where I was like, look, I'm satisfied with this grade. I won't bother you if you don't bother me. And I'm just going to try and get through this high school thing. So I was a middling student in high school. I was fairly apathetic about school in general, but I was always a self-motivated learner. I read a lot. My grandmother and my mother kept our house full of books. And so even though I didn't really apply myself in school, I ended up doing well on the standardized tests. And I had a chance to go to a top flight university. And in fact, I never would have gone to Cornell if my counselor, teacher and friend, Jonathan Sherry, hadn't pulled me aside and said at the start of my senior year that they were going to put me on the advanced track. So all through high school, I wasn't on the advanced track, but until the SATs, they put me on it. And he said, what you'll have to do, you'll have to drop English and sign up for AP English, sign up for AP History, sign up for AP Economics, and instead of taking physics, sign up for AP Bio. So I did, and my physics teacher, who was of course my neighbor, because I grew up in a village of 800 people, stops me in the hallway and she says, what are you doing? You have to take physics. I was like, Mr. Sherry said I should take AP Bio. He said, well, Andrew so-and-so, somebody a couple years older than me, said, applied to Cornell to be an engineer and didn't get in because he never took physics. Now, this is the first time I'd ever heard the word Cornell before, but I was a dutiful student. I went back to Mr. Sherry and I said, Andrew didn't get into Cornell, so I have to take physics.
And Mr. Sherry says, well, let's find out about that. So he picks up the phone. He looked in the phone book. This is the era we're talking about, kids, 04, 05, and calls Cornell University and says, I've got a student here. These are his grades. These are his test scores. Should he take physics or should he take AP bio? And they said he should take AP bio and he should come visit. And that was it. That was history. I came and visit. I fell in love with the place, the waterfalls, the campus, the people, the size of the place seemed massive to me at the time, still seems massive to me. And I decided to come here.
Not to turn this into a travelogue, I always find it very interesting to ask people the first moment they realized that they loved or wanted to go to Cornell. For me, I remember so specifically driving over a hill and seeing it in the distance. I was like, well, I'm going here. This is good. Let's do that. Was there a moment like that for you?
Yeah, for sure. I was standing on the bridge to North Campus. And this is, again, to date myself, this is back when the what was left of the hydropower plant was still standing. And here was a massive waterfall falling into, through, and around this gorgeous, hollowed out old building. I thought I had messed around and ended up at Hogwarts. I mean, I really thought I was I'd stumbled on something magic, and I was right.
Now, it sounds like this started to change towards the end of your high school career anyway, but was there something at Cornell or during college that turns you from a relatively ambivalent or unfocused student to focusing you on government, on running for politics?
Well, sure. I mean, I never became a focused student, which is, as some of my professors who are listening right now were waiting for me to say that and are now like, good. No, I never became a focused student because I was always a bit distracted by what was happening outside the classroom. And that was true in high school too. You know, I had my job. I worked at the grocery store. I was a DJ at the local college radio station, DJ Savante. I was the youngest DJ in their history. I started when I was 15. So my show was called Breaking Curfew.
Oh, man, you got to put that at the front of your bio, not the mayor thing.
I know.
Much bigger.
Well, it's true. I would do Friday nights until 2 a.m. And I was like, what could these college students be doing Friday night that they wouldn't want to host a radio show? What's wrong with them? I found out later. But I was always involved. I mean, I was involved in my church, and then I became politically active. I mean, my first act of politics, and this comes from going to the store sometime with cash and sometimes with food stamps, and having my mom explain to me the difference and why it was we needed food stamps, even though she was working two jobs. You know, she worked two minimum wage jobs, but with three and then later four kids, it was just still hard to make ends meet. And so that those food stamps made sure that we got fed so that we could grow and we could ourselves become, you know, healthy, functional adults. So knowing all that and then watching some people say, you know, watch the truck go by with a bumper sticker that says, work harder, someone on food stamps needs your help, a lazy person on food stamps, I would say, wow, that doesn't seem... It just doesn't seem right to me. So my first act of political sabotage was to steal every Bob Dole sign in my village back in 96 and hide them in my garage, which, you know, my mom, I've never seen her angrier. I had to put them all back. But so I was always sort of engaged, and something of a rabble rouser in my high school. And that didn't stop when I came to Cornell. I mean, I got involved in the Greek system, but also working downtown. I both ran a tutoring program at Boynton Middle School, but also worked with the older kids at the high school through Cornell Cooperative Extension, all while working nights at the Royal Palm Tavern, or as most folks know it, the Palms. So I was always engaged and active outside of the classroom. And I think it was in part because I didn't understand until it was too late, just what a useful learning ground school can be, where you can take chances and learn without risk of failure. And for me, the risk was always sort of what made it feel real. So I think I always thrived more in real world environments.
What led to your first decision to run for office?
Oh boy. months of deliberation. That was maybe the hardest choice I ever made, is to step off of campus in campus life and to get involved in the real world. What helped was that I had mentors, people like Gayrod Townsend, who was my boss through the Cornell Cooperative Extension. He had already served on the city council, so he knew how to do it. He knew how important housing was to me, and especially what was happening in Collegetown at that time. Collegetown at this moment is in quite a period of transition of construction, new housing, new office space, a new grocery store, all of which are positive and healthy developments. But at that time, there hadn't been any new growth in Collegetown in 3 decades. The rent was going through the roof, and the quality of housing was just abysmal. It was unsafe and unclean. So he showed me how to do it. He showed me how to gather petitions and how to put my money where my mouth is. You know, folks who know me know that I'm very opinionated, that I can't read a newspaper all the way through without stopping to yell at it. Or pausing CNN every 12 seconds to say, you know what's wrong with these people? And to get off the couch and off the sidelines and to join the real world discourse was quite a leap, but I'm glad I took it.
Well, but it's a bigger leap to go from the town council to the mayorship. Again, what was the decision process there? What was that like?
Boy, that was really tough. I had enjoyed my time on council. I'd had some successes, but was frustrated in general that the city wasn't moving more quickly towards a more inclusive, more affordable, more welcoming city for everybody who wanted to live here. So I was faced really with a crossroads. I was either going to leave the council and likely leave government forever and go to law school, or run for mayor. And it wasn't until a friend of mine, George Didoon, passed away in 2011. He was a young man. He was still in school then. He was 20 years old, just 3 years younger than me. And I got to sit with his mother in Brooklyn at the funeral and speak with his priest and really hear from them how, not just how proud they were of him, but how full his life was, because he did not delay chasing the things he wanted, and he never wavered in going after, even when things were scary. And so that conversation really convinced me to make the leap, to say, I know what I'm supposed to be doing. To do anything less than that is just to give in to fear. And if I lose, then I lose, but at least I'll have tried. So I went for it.
Was there anything to, because you had, relatively speaking, moved around so much, to think, okay, if I'm going to be the mayor of Ithaca, that means really setting down roots and focusing on this place. Was that part of the decision-making process for you?
For sure. I actually think that's why, to me, the decision I agonized over more was running for the city council. Hmm. You know, that was a 4-year term that started my junior year. And so for me, it meant deciding that Ithaca was going to be my home. And that was a weighty thing. You know, I'm not, you know, Earlville became my home, but that was after 10 years or so of living there. I've moved more times than I even know how to count. And so moving was just natural to me. In fact, I've lived in every neighborhood in the city of Ithaca. I move every 6 months, it seems, just because, because the rent's too damn high, frankly. But that was the big leap. Once I decided to stay here for the city council, I mean, this place really, it embraced me, it adopted me, it felt like home in all the ways that were important. So deciding to stay on as mayor wasn't as big a leap for me.
Still, though, at age of 24, it's kind of, there's a lot going against you in terms of becoming a mayor. I don't know if you ever watched Parks and Recreation. You're not a teen mayor, but on that show, there's the teen mayor who sets up this place called Icetown, and he gets completely ripped apart for it. Did you deal with anything like that when you were running?
Sure. Well, the Icetown makes Ice Clown frown is the headline none of us want to see. You want to avoid Ben Wyatt's fate. Sure. And, you know, honestly, people are so polite
that they often didn't tell me to my face that they thought I was too young. It wasn't until I ran for re-election 4 years later, and I was 28, so not that much older, but I guess folks were used to me. I knocked on the same doors, you know, knocked on every door in the city of Ithaca 2.5 times when I ran the first time. When I ran for re-election, I knocked on every door once. And some of the people who had been so friendly to me and who I assumed had voted for me 4 years prior, when I knocked on their door, they would open and say, "Oh yeah, I'd vote for you this time." And I said, "This time? What happened last time?" And like, "Oh, I thought you were way too young last time. But you've done a fine job, and I'll vote for you again." So you know, you never feel the full weight of what people are saying about you, even in public life, because folks are so polite that they don't say it right to you. But I think everybody's concerns are the same. Is this person serious-minded enough for the job? Do they have enough experience to do it well? Are they going to make mistakes? Are they going to be reckless? And are they going to be irresponsible? And the answer to all of those was yes, in some small part. Certainly the make mistakes part. But that I've tried to bring some of the benefits of youth to the energy and enthusiasm and a willingness to take chances and to take risks and to be bold, you know, into projects like rebuilding the commons, which a lot of folks thought was going to be like an ice town situation, you know, too expensive, too inconvenient, not worth it in the long run. But if you've been on the commons lately, you know that it's beautiful, that the investment was well worth it. It's going to last 100 years at least. And it spurred this $13 million project that we did to rebuild the heart of our city has spurred $300 million worth of growth on and around the commons from people who decided that they're going to build and open up businesses in the heart of our downtown. It's a boom the likes of which the city's never seen. You know, in the years since we rebuilt the commons, we have grown faster. Our economy's grown faster than anywhere in the state. Just last week, the new job results came out for this quarter, and once again, we surpassed New York City and every place else in the state in boosting a growing economy. So yeah, there's certainly, you're always worried that any misstep you make is going to be attributed to your age, but you learn pretty quickly that nobody's perfect and that you're not going to be perfect. So when you get something wrong, you just got to hustle and try and make it right.
I think you just covered maybe the answer to this a little bit, but all over the country right now, there are a lot of younger people, a lot of people who have little or no political experience who are either running for office or getting ready to run for office. Obviously, every race is completely different. Every city is different. But do you have a piece of advice for folks like that who are potentially getting into a big political job or want to get into a big political job for the first time?
Yeah, not just a piece of advice. I have a whole curriculum through the I now run. So for the last 6 years, I've had only one job, and that's very unusual for me. So for the last year, I've now added a second job, which is the director of youth leadership programs for People for the American Way. So I now travel the country on weekends and teach courses in how to run for office, how to win, but then also how to be effective when you're in office. We now have a network of 1,200 people who ran and won under the age of 35. And not only do we support those young people in their political careers, but we also draw on their knowledge to help educate all of the folks who are trying to get into office now. So what would be my advice to young people? Well, one is to go to the People for the American Way's website and sign up for one of our programs. But the other would be that to be authentic. I mean, if the election of 2016 taught us anything, it's that the world is a nightmare and we should all hide. No. If it taught us anything, it's that people will forgive your foibles and your sins and even areas where they disagree with you if they believe that you are being authentic and that you care about them. And I think we do ourselves a disservice by being so straight-laced all the time, by trying to pretend to be automatons, by trying to appeal to everyone while saying nothing. When the truth is, it's okay to be who you are. You know, folks will
forgive. I can't tell you how many people that I've gone to battle with on the city council or in the realm of public opinion and clashed with, but still I consider allies because all of our differences we've come about honestly, and we've always been genuine with each other. So I think that would be my best advice, that and knock on doors. There's no other way to win a campaign. There's no more effective way to win a campaign. Knock on every door you can and just talk to the person who lives there.
I do want to get back and talk about Ithaca in a second, but I do think this is interesting to pursue, particularly because you have been traveling around the country. If you look at the internet, if you look at newspapers, you certainly get one story that's being told of, like you said, doom and gloom and everybody hide. But then you also see, it seems that there is this rising tide of people who want to be involved in government, who do want change. What are you seeing as you travel around the country?
There's no question about it. First of all, women are more motivated. They are volunteering more. They are running for office more. They're winning more. They're donating more. I've seen it from California to Maine. In Seattle, I saw it in Minneapolis. I campaigned in Florida. I've seen it in Connecticut. That 2018 will be, already has been, the year of the woman, and that this is likely to continue, and I think will define our generation of politics as women leading, where for the last 150 years, they've really been forced to lead from the background. That is to say, they've been pushing on a whole host of almost always progressive issues, but doing so from behind the scenes. Now they're stepping in front of the cameras. The second thing I'm seeing is a ton of young people run for office. You know, I've been part of the Young Elected Officials Network for 11 years. I'm now in charge of the Young Elected Officials Network. And we've never seen in our history this kind of willingness to step out and to run for school boards, city councils, mayorships. So I think this is going to reshape our politics for a generation. And I believe, based on the people I've seen running for office, I think it's going to reshape it for the better. We started a PAC called the Next Up Victory Fund to support young people running for office. And that PAC so far endorsed 123 people under the age of 35 who are running for serious positions. Most have won, and many more are challenging right now. And so through that Next Up Fund, I really believe I'm seeing the future of our country.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but there's a lot of discussion right now about liberalism versus socialism and what is the future of the Democratic Party. Do you have a take on that?
No. I think it's healthy to argue about. I don't think you'll ever have an answer. I think anytime somebody says that a particular ism is the answer, you should not trust them anymore, you know, because they haven't lived enough in the real world. So whether it's somebody saying, well, if we only adopted libertarianism or capitalism or conservatism or socialism, I'd say that, well, listen, before, you know, in a job like mine where I make 20 to 30 decisions a day, I will make a libertarian decision, a conservative decision, a liberal decision, and a socialist decision all before lunch. That each problem is complicated in its own way. It comes with its own context, and you can't use any one ideology to solve all the problems that a complicated modern society faces. So what you have to do instead is find your North Star. Right, find what your values are and put every question through that same prism. And for me, it's that right now, nobody has it worse in our country than the poor, that they don't have to have it as bad as they do, and that we can adjust things, we can fix our system to make life for the poor just a little bit better without making life for everybody else any worse at all.
Let's jump back to Ithaca. You talked about the Commons and your project there. You've taken a bunch of other big swings in the city. I'm curious to hear about the safe injection sites that you're looking to set up. Can you talk about that project?
Yeah, sure, of course. So you might know that the opioid epidemic killed more people last year than the entire Vietnam War did. It killed more Americans than the entire Vietnam War did. That it's now killing more people than the AIDS epidemic did in its worst year, and that things aren't getting better. That here in Tompkins County in Ithaca, we're averaging 2 overdose deaths each month, and that all of the policies, these war on drug policies that we've tried, hasn't made the problem any better. In fact, it's made it a bit worse, and it's cost the taxpayers about $2 trillion. So I put together a committee of 50 people in 2014, and I asked them to come up with solutions that would help save lives and ease suffering without just arresting a bunch of people, because we know that that doesn't work. What they came up with was a 25-point plan called the Ithaca Plan that's got recommendations about treatment and law enforcement and harm reduction. And of course, its most controversial point, which was supervised injection facilities. This is an idea that instead of allowing people to use out on the street and alleyways and dumpsters and fast food bathrooms, instead you open the doors to a place, so it could be a small office. You say, if you're using on the street, why don't you come use in here under the supervision of a nurse? And it sounds crazy at first, because it sounds like you're encouraging or condoning drug use. But what's it been proven to do in 10 other countries around the world is it's been proven to lower disease transmission, because you can be sure people are using clean needles. It's been proven to lower the incidence of vandalism, graffiti, assaults, and discarded needles out in public. And to me, here's the real big kicker. It's been proven to be a pathway into treatment, that folks coming into contact with a nurse every day, somebody who cares about their life and their health, has encouraged those people to enter treatment. So people who use these supervised injection facilities are 35% more likely to enter treatment than people who don't. So Switzerland's done this, and they've reduced the overdose rate by 2/3. If we were able to reduce our overdose rate by 2/3, we would have 4,000 fewer funerals in America last year.
Not to draw too much of a line, and certainly they're different drugs, but it seems like this is at least in part inspired by your experience as a kid. Is that accurate?
Oh, sure, no question. Yeah, I mean, I got a firsthand view of how ineffective the war on drugs was. You know, if arresting someone and forcing them to go to jail or forcing them to go to rehab before they're ready to go to rehab was going to work, it would have worked for my father the first 6 or 7 times that it happened. And so I thought, well, I thought maybe that was just him, or maybe that was just our family and we were unlucky. But it took actually going to Cornell, taking government courses, taking the prisons course by Dr. Katzenstein, and eventually becoming head of a police department, to see that it wasn't just me, that this entire system that jailed people who use drugs, tried to force them into sobriety, was very expensive and very stupid. It just doesn't work. I mean, there's nobody in the system who thinks it works. But there's also a lot of fear about going to a different model. And I was less afraid. You know, the way our city is, it's always forward looking, it's always forward thinking, and it's a very smart city. That is to say, it doesn't want to do something that's not working over and over again. So I went for it.
And another policy that you've been working pretty heavily on, and it's a big topic of discussion in the country right now, is making Ithaca a refugee city, or at least welcoming to refugees. Can you talk about that a bit?
No, so our history in Ithaca has been, and in this region, has been that of a sanctuary space. You know, whether it was slaves fleeing the South and under penalty of law, against the law, Ithacans and people in upstate New York hid the slaves and helped them move on to Canada, all the way to the present day, where our city has been made great and strong by the contributions of refugees from Bosnia, from Syria, and from Tibet. And I think what the current administration is doing, both in the front of folks fleeing war in Central America and fleeing war in Iraq and Syria, to keep those people out is one of the most immoral and pathetic things I've ever seen the United States government do. To be the most powerful, secure, wealthy nation on earth, and to say that the poorest people who are fleeing oppression and violence, that we cannot afford to or don't feel safe, welcoming those people to our shores, it not only runs in the face of the best of American history, but it reminds me of the worst acts in world history.
What, you touched on this again a little bit, but what do you think the role of a mayor is in national politics at this point?
Oh boy. Maybe to talk some sense into everybody. I mean, mayors, mayors have the, I don't know if you know this, but mayors have the highest approval ratings of any elected officials. Why is that? It's because we're smart and we're good looking. It's because we are forced to be pragmatic instead of dogmatic. Right? We can't just say, well, I'm a libertarian, so that's not the way I'm going to vote. Instead, we're forced to solve problems in whatever ways we can. And we're not able to run away from our constituents, to go back to D.C. and to just say, well, I tried, but the folks are crazy. And if you elect me again, maybe I'll try some more. Now, people want to see results. And so I think the role of a mayor is to in some cases to inspire, in some cases to push back, but always to defend the right of the people who live in their city to chart their own destiny. Right now, for example, President Trump's administration has us all cities under assault. You know, he is trying to attack the very thing that most Republicans for the last 30 years have fought for, which is federalism, the right for local places, cities, towns, villages, and states to make their own laws, to enforce those laws, and to do so without interference from the federal government. Trump has a full-throated assault on a whole host of those, but especially when it comes to immigration. Something that's been hurting the university is his stance both towards undocumented immigrants, many of whom are going to Cornell right now, and even legal immigrants. He wants to make it harder to come here, harder to go to school here, harder to get an education here, and to set down roots here. And I think that is the, I mean, just frankly, it's the ideology of somebody who's too scared. Too scared of his own shadow, too scared of these people who have such little power, but so much potential, too scared to be the leader of a nation that's so great.
You've been pretty open about your inspiration from another president, Barack Obama. And I hear a lot of that in what you're talking about, going door to door and talking to people, engaging the community. What has been your biggest takeaway from him?
I got to tell you, his example and his friendship have changed my life. So it's hard for me to be objective. I think my biggest takeaway from President Obama is to not overreact. You know, people are going to say mean stuff. They're going to be nasty. They're going to be cruel. They're going to be... you know, the worst parts of American life are still there, but that, to paraphrase another president, President Bill Clinton, is that there's nothing wrong with America that can't be fixed by what's right with America. That if you have confidence in people, if you have faith, if you treat everybody like a grown-up, if you explain the way you're thinking, if you explain why you're making a certain decision, well, not everybody's going to love you, not everybody's going to like you, but that you're going to be able to make progress. And that progress might be slow and steady, but it will come. And I think that's been the most important takeaway for me, is that it's his patience, his calmness, and his ability to treat everybody like adults, even the people he disagrees with.
given that you don't have exactly the same stories, but you do have very parallel stories, and he went from community organizer to senator to making the jump to running for president, do you have similar ambitions?
Well, I went to Cornell and he went to Harvard, so I have the better resume to this point. I don't have similar ambitions. My ambition is the same in that I hope to stay in public service in some way. Like, it's hard for me now to imagine not being trying to make myself useful to the public, either in elected office or outside it, in government in some way, or in the nonprofit world. So I hope to stay in office. I may run for higher office, but I haven't decided. You know, everybody I talk to, and I get a chance to interface now with senators and governors, and just about any of them who has been a mayor will tell you that was the peak of their professional career. That was the most fun they ever had, and that they wish they could be a mayor again. And I don't know if that's just the case of the grass is always greener, but I could understand why it would be true. This is the best job I can imagine. You feel useful, but you feel connected. You feel like the work you do matters, and you don't spend all day fundraising or glad handing. I mean, you spend all day working, and it's a nice gig. So I'm not sure what happens next, but I'm looking forward to it, whatever it is.
I don't know. Just Big Red alumni, first president, sounds pretty good to me. I'm just throwing that out there. Just
well,
something
I have
to think about.
Some of my classmates that I think would do a better job than me. So I'll send you their names too.
Before we let you go, what is next for Ithaca? What are you working on right now that people should be aware of?
Oh, tons. I mean, for the university community, the changes that are coming to College Town already over the last 3 years have been quite a lot of upheaval. But in the next 3 years, we'll see a wholesale transformation of what it means to live and work in College Town. And all of those changes will be for the better. New student housing, new faculty housing, and new office and classroom space coming right to College Avenue, I think is going to be a major improvement. We're also working on our waterfront. We've completed the waterfront trail, a trail that goes from all the way from Teganic Falls, the state park. You can ride 8 miles down the trail and connect to our waterfront trail that'll go from Cass Park to Stewart Park. And it's beautiful if you've ever seen it. Right along that waterfront, we're going to be removing a DOT site, about 10 acres, and redeveloping that, all while investing more in the sort of social safety net, including drug treatment and harm reduction services that make the city a more secure and more healthy place to live. So there's a lot happening, a lot to look forward to on the horizon, including a big redevelopment of our airport that will add 3 new gates and an international customs facility. So everything's on the up and up.
And if there are any young alumni who are listening who do want to get involved back in the government in Ithaca, what would you recommend? What's the best resource for them to check out?
There's a ton of ways to get involved, including the City of Ithaca's website. You can look up how to volunteer, how to join one of our boards and committees. We've just restructured our entire committee structure for the first time in 3 generations. And they can email me directly at mayor@cityofithaca.org. I always love hearing from alumni, and especially any young alumni. If you're still in the area, it'd be great to get together.
All right, very cool. Svante, thank you so much for chatting. It was really
absolutely
a pleasure.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you guys for listening to Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. Again, if you want to check out more information, alumni.cornell.edu/young alumni. And also you can check out the Facebook page, Cornell Young Alumni Programs, for upcoming events, news, volunteer opportunities, and more. Music from Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2014. You can contact him at KOA3@cornell.edu.